Did you know that Loki was a gender-bending god? In today's episode, we talk about gender in medieval Icelandic literature. Welcome to the Medieval Grad Podcast. It's a podcast brought to you by Medievalist.net, where we chat with graduate students and early career researchers to learn about the new trends in medieval studies. I'm Lucie Lemonnier, a medieval historian and the podcast's host. And today I'm talking with Matthew Robbie, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Medieval Studies at the University of Toronto in Canada. Hello, Matthew. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello, it's very nice to be here.
So Matthew, you received your PhD at the University of Oxford, England in 2019. Then you did a postdoc at the University of Iceland in Iceland, and now you are in Toronto. And so since grad school, you've been interested in medieval conceptions of sex, sexuality, and gender through the proxy of Old Norse and Icelandic literature. You also ask how depictions of supernatural entities can be analyzed to explore medieval mentalities and norms surrounding gender, sex, and sexuality. So there is a lot to discuss here, so we'll go step by step. First, tell us a little bit about this Old Norse Icelandic literature and the supernatural entities you found there.
It's probably good to start by defining our terms. When used by scholars, the term Old Norse is still used, but that is used primarily to identify the language that was spoken by the Germanic peoples of continental Scandinavia and its outposts between the 8th and 15th centuries. Although those dates are not absolute, there are no concrete boundaries like 1066 creating a difference between those, between Proto-Norse before Old Norse and between Old Norse and the modern Scandinavian languages that evolved out of it. But in general, we say between the 8th and 15th century. But Old Norse Icelandic is the term that we usually give to the literature. And the reason that we add on that Icelandic at the end, hyphenated, is to reflect the fact that the vast majority of the literary output produced in that language, including some very famous components like the Eddas and the Sagas, were either composed in Iceland or only come down to us in Icelandic manuscripts, even if we think it's that they were written elsewhere. One of the things that drew me to Old Norse Icelandic literature in the first place is that it is incredibly rich. It has very many different genres, some of which are very unique in the medieval context as a whole. And so I'll just introduce perhaps a few of those important texts and genres. Maybe one of the most noteworthy is the Poetic Edda, which is a collection of poems which comes down to us in a 13th century manuscript. That's the first manuscript we have of it, although the material that's in that perhaps has pre-Christian origin, we can't know. We just know that it's at least as old as the 13th century, but those poems in the Poetic Edda are about the gods and heroes of pre-Christian medieval Norse society. And so perhaps the matter that's in the stories is pre-Christian. And another important text is the Prose Edda, which we know was composed in the 13th century by a man named Snorri Sturluson, who was an Icelandic poet and historian, who obviously had a great interest in the pre-Christian culture and religion. And that is the Poetic Edda is basically an attempt to draw together what sources Snorri had about that culture and try and put it into a unified form. People often say that it's like he was trying to write a Bible of, because obviously, we don't know very much about pre-Christian religion in medieval Scandinavia, and perhaps Snorri didn't either, because he's writing more than two centuries after conversion. But he's taking together disparate sources and trying to make them into a unified set of stories. And those together, the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, are known as the Eddic corpus. And then, of course, the other great corpus within Old Norse Icelandic literature is that of the sagas. The most famous ones being the family sagas, which are a uniquely well-developed long prose form composed in around the 13th century and the few centuries after that, but presumably based on material that existed before that point.
Yeah, I don't know much because I'm a historian of the Mediterranean, southern France. It sounds like when they were composed in the 13th century, these poems or prose were kind of like, you know, books of folklore tales that you heard and that they put together to kind of remember times that are far gone.
Particularly in Iceland, people had a vested interest in exploring the past because they identified with this settler community that moved out of continental Scandinavia around the 9th and 10th centuries. And at the time, those people were pre-Christian. They were Norse pagans. And so the Icelanders have an interest in looking at where their nationality comes from. Because as a settler community, perhaps they're looking for an identity, which is something other than being exiles or refugees, and so they have an interest in trying to maybe honor that past and portray it sometimes in a more positive light. So where we don't find references to pre-Christian cultures in other European Christian contexts. That might be one of the reasons why we do find it in the Old Norse Icelandic corpus. They are about the settlers. The Íslendingasögur, which are the family sagas, many of them are about the settlers who first came to Iceland, and they are not Christian either. They adhere to the pre-Christian religion. And so again, what we might take from the fact that Iceland produced this huge corpus of literature about pre-Christian heroes, in the family sagas, is that they were interested in honouring them and showing them in a positive light and showing how settlement occurred because there were these independently spirited, independent-minded, democracy-loving Vikings who came and settled Iceland because they didn't want to be oppressed in continental Scandinavia by kings or chieftains. And so that again is like, obviously, we only know that these texts were extant in the 13th century and later because we have manuscripts from then. And in fact, we don't even have very many 13th century manuscripts of family sagas. But we presume that they are based on story material that comes from before that time. And in addition to that, even though the family sagas are the most famous corpus of sagas from Old Norse Icelandic literature, there are other saga genres too, including legendary sagas, sagas about kings and bishops, and also romances, which is where my research is currently taking me. So throughout this corpus, there is a lot of supernatural or paranormal stuff, which was another big draw for me to get into it. Like, there's lots of ghosts and witches and ogre-type cave-dwelling trolls. And the way that I look at them, the basic critical paradigm, is based on that was proposed by Geoffrey Jerome Cohen. Most famously, although others had also done similar work beforehand, which was that you can look at supernatural entities as a means of accessing topics that might have been uncomfortable to discuss in more realistic depictions. So because these witches and ghosts and trolls are, they're not part of everyday life, they have some supernatural distance, which allows the authors and presumably also the audiences to use them to think about and explore controversial subjects. And so some scholars have noticed that they can bear sexual connotations and they can be used to discuss sexual themes. And that is where my work is as well. And I think it might be good to give a very clear example. There's one very clear example of the way that supernatural depictions are used in Old Norse Icelandic literature to discuss sexuality. And that is the figure of the ogre-type troll woman who often wears like a short skirt, which the texts say is too short and therefore reveals either her genitals or her buttocks, and they also they're often all very verbally sexually active as well, like expressing their interest in human heroes, trying to attack them but in a sexual way. Sometimes they also have sex with heroes as well, but sometimes the sexuality between a hero and a troll woman is sort of veiled in a depiction of very physical manual wrestling. But that's just a good example of how, obviously, like, the texts don't usually discuss female hypersexuality and what Icelanders thought about that in a realistic depiction, because it's too uncomfortable to depict a human person being so libidinous. But they can explore what they would think about female hypersexuality in a hypothetical sense by depicting it in a monster like a troll. And so that's where my work is.
It's very fascinating. I never heard of the troll woman. I picture them very big. I don't know if it was the case.
Yeah, well, this is actually an important point. The word troll is very nebulous in the sources, and it can be used to describe anything that is supernatural. And it can even be used to describe anything that is vaguely related to pagan religion as well, because these authors don't only have an uncomplicatedly positive relationship with the pagan past. Sometimes they portray pagans very positively because they think of them as their ancestors and their founding, you know, settler generation. But sometimes they, and as you might expect, because they are Christians by the time we have manuscripts, sometimes they portray pagans very negatively. And so sometimes the word troll can be used to describe anything that is vaguely related to paganism as well. But it does also have this meaning of a big, usually ugly, deformed being that's not human, but human in shape and lives in the mountains or in a cave or a rock. And so the troll is used to describe those people, those beings. And maybe that is one of its primary meanings, because sometimes we come across phrases like someone was as big as a troll or someone was as strong as a troll, which therefore gives the indication that medieval Icelanders did think of a troll as being this big, strong thing. But it is a very nebulous term, so you have to use it very carefully when you're studying the trolls in the sagas.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about gender. How was gender construed in this text? And do you find major differences with continental and Christian perceptions of gender?
Well, as I said, most of Scandinavia, including Iceland, was Christianized around the year 1000. And that was when Latin literacy and the custom of manuscript writing were adopted. So since the extant texts, apart from a few short extracts or images carved on runic picture stones, all the extant texts generally come to us from versions that were written within the Christian era, usually from at least two centuries after Christianization. So it's difficult to know how well any of them, even those ones that might have pre-Christian origins, like the works in the Eddas, might reflect pre-Christian understandings of gender. But if those texts do reflect any nuggets of pre-Christian value or belief, the texts that have pre-Christian origins, like the Eddic poems, do contain some very interesting depictions concerning gender. And most obviously, they depict gender bending, whether this is people embodying traits that are usually associated with another gender or actually changing their gender magically. We get presentations in the Eddic materials of male gods changing their gender or doing things that problematize their male or masculine status. So one very famous example is the story when Loki becomes a mare, it becomes a female horse and actually gives birth to another horse in a female form. And that's not the only time that he becomes a female either. And this ultimately has a positive effect. He changes into a female horse because they have to prevent it's quite a complicated story, but basically a giant has agreed to build a fortress for the gods and they give him a time limit, and they think he won't be able to complete it within the time limit, but he has this really strong stallion who helps him. And so eventually the giant, with the stallion's help, they almost manage to complete the wall in time. And so the gods don't know what to do, so they call upon Loki, who apparently was the person who negotiated this contract in the first place, to do something about it. And he changes into a female horse in order to distract the stallion, and therefore the work can't be completed. And so it does have a positive effect, but Loki is not an uncomplicated figure at all. He's a trickster figure, sometimes an evil figure even. And this act that he performs, where he transforms into a mare, is sometimes explicitly denigrated in some texts, like in Lorcasenna, for example. And so it's difficult to know what a pre-Christian audience might have made of that kind of gender bending. The god Odin is also somewhat ambiguous in terms of gender, because he practices a form of magic which is associated with women, associated with femininity. And in some texts, it seems like his gender bending is licensed because he's a god, whereas in others, it's denigrated. And like I said, Loki's gender switching is also denigrated. So it's difficult to know, did we have gods who freely changed their gender and people were okay with that because they were gods and that was part of that culture? Or do we have the denigration that comes across in some of the texts? Is that a feature of the pre-Christian texts, or is it a later thing that was added by Christian poets? And I suppose we can't really know. And then, but in the other direction, the Eddic materials do contain figures who are female and embody traditionally masculine traits. The best example might be Valkyries and Shield Maidens, women who take up arms and perform martial deeds. And in the Eddic texts, they often seem to be esteemed for this. So again, it's difficult to know what exactly reflects a pre-Christian ideology, because we don't know when the texts were written, nor do we know whether they were later edited by Christian authors. But those are some interesting examples regarding gender that come out in the texts that might have pre-Christian origins. But even in texts that we know were not composed in the pagan past, later sagas, like the legendary sagas and the romances, they also contain figures that are very interesting from a gender perspective. The most noteworthy would be the Maiden King, which becomes a uniquely Icelandic figure. You have these women who don't want to be submissive, and they become the king of their region, usually when their father dies. And in some cases, they insist on being called a king. They take male names. And the narrator even responds to that by giving them male pronouns while they are a maiden king. And so there are, these texts we do think are from the post-conversion era. And so clearly that culture was interested in the concept of gender fluidity. Now, when it comes to these maiden kings, they are not usually esteemed like Valkyries and Shield Maidens are. They usually get reprimanded and their power gets overturned, and eventually they end up being submissive, usually to a man. But it's still very interesting that while they are kings, they rule their kingdoms well, and they even lead troops into battle effectively. And so there are lots of interesting figures from a gender perspective in the corpus.
Yeah, and what I find very interesting is actually all the uncertainty, the fact that we don't know whether these are old traditions or kind of new traditions. You know, I mean, the way in which people perceive them, or are they criticizing? I think this is very, I find it interesting. I like when we don't know in history, because it's where we can work, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, when you have such a nebulous corpus like the Eddic poems, they can also contradict themselves. So like I said, sometimes Odin seems to be, his gender bending and his gender fluidity when it comes to the use of this magic seems to be tolerated and even considered appropriate, perhaps because he's a god. But then in other texts, he's shamed for that same behavior. So maybe there was not a unified ideology. Maybe there was a unified ideology, but then one of those ideologies is actually a reflection of the post-Christian editing of those stories. So yeah, it is fascinating stuff. All of those things are a little bit fantastical, like the maiden kings and the gods. They usually appear in fantastical texts. But even in the realistic texts of the sagas, there are some powerful women who embody usually male roles, including enacting violence on their own. Very famously, some women declare themselves divorced from their husbands. And there's even a very famous matriarch who controls her family and controls her own inheritance until she dies at a very old age, called Undur Djupudka, in the sagas. And so even though those are not quite as fantastical as the Maiden Kings or the Shield Maidens or Valkyries, they still do seem to show some recognition of females showing authority in what we might consider traditionally male roles. This is not to say that the more predictable roles don't appear. In general, men, but both genders can be venerated for being strong and authoritative, but usually they enact that in two separate ways that are gender determined. Men can enact public power and can enact violence, and women generally just influence things within the domestic sphere, and they can goad men to do violence. And so there we do see what I guess you would consider more predictable gender norms, but there are obviously exceptions. It's such a rich and diverse corpus that there are always exceptions.
And I'm wondering also about other instances of gender bending characters in continental literature. I'm thinking, for instance, of the Roman de Silence, which is, I think, a 13th century a French text, and it's the story of this originally a little girl, and she was born to a king, but because of her sex and gender, she cannot inherit, she cannot become king, and so her parents raise her as a boy. She uses a male pronouns. She's really like raised as a boy, and after a series of adventures, Silence meets another king, and I think the queen wants to have an affair with him, but Silence knows that he cannot because he's actually a woman, and so he reveals his identity and sort of comes off as a woman. And I think that the point of the story is just to say that being a woman is really a hassle, and because if you're a woman, you cannot inherit, you cannot become a king, you cannot become a knight, you cannot do as you please. And so women has it, you know, much harder than men. And that's kind of the moral of the story. And it's not necessarily about gender bending, it's more about, I would say, gender norms. Does that resonate with Norse literature? And do you see kind of similar phenomenon in the texts that you're studying?
Yeah, no, I have actually come across the Roman de Silence. It did not come to mind, but I think it is a bit similar to the Maiden Kings, because they know that if they remain female, they will not be able to, like, usually they're a princess, or they begin as the daughter of a king, but they know that they won't be able to rule or inherit that society, inherit the throne if they remain a female. And so, and then of course, once they have adopted a masculine identity, especially in a couple of texts, they get very angry if anyone addresses them as a woman or refers to their femaleness. And so even there is this embedded notion that being a man is necessary, or sorry, being a man was considered necessary for certain activities like ruling or leading an army. And so that might have that. Those stories might have the same basic concept underlying them, a quite sad, tragic concept from our perspective, that it's about how women, when they are just women, can't get by and they have to pretend to be men, or in some cases, not just pretend, but actually adopt a male identity in reality. But then, like I said, there is this especially interesting example from the family sagas, a very realistic example about this old woman, Unnur, who is one of the settlers. She doesn't have to adopt a masculine identity in order to rule. She becomes a matriarch. She has a crew, which includes men and women. When she gets to Iceland, she doles out land, which is what all of the prominent settlers do, but all of the others are male. When they get there, they dole out land to their followers. But Unnur does the same, and she's a woman. And then she lives in her own house and controls things in that house, and also seems to control the doings of her family and even of the people in her region until she dies. And then she's the one to choose her heir. And all the time that she's alive, there are appropriate males, including her grandson, who could take over for her if there was this notion that a woman can't lead. But for one reason or another, Unnur is allowed to lead as a matriarch without changing her, without adopting a male personality or identity.
Okay, and we love strong old women.
Yes.
So thank you very much, Matthew. It will be all for this episode. So if you're listening, don't worry. Next episode, we are keeping the conversation going and we're talking more specifically about sexuality. So Matthew, thank you very much. And we are going to keep talking, but you at home, just wait for 1 week or two and you'll have the second part of the episode about sexuality.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That was Matthew Robey, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto. You can find out more about Matthew in the show notes. And our discussion is not over yet. Stay tuned for the next episode. We'll keep on hearing about Icelandic literature. Stay with us, because the episode isn't over yet. Let's bring in Peter Konichny from medievalist.net. Hi, Peter. How are you? What did you think of this interview?
Hey, pretty good. You know, it was interesting to kind of see how he's trying to kind of figure out where is kind of pre-Christian, kind of Norse culture, pagan, and then what's the Christian influence? And like, And that is kind of an exciting way of kind of looking at like the as cultures change, but you know, where does that like leave things like gender fluidity, and all that kind of fun stuff that like we were kind of exploring right now in history. So I was kind of, I really liked it. I wish I had this episode came out a few weeks more, because I'm expecting this book.
Oh,
it's called the Bearded Bride, but it's actually it's a translation of like one of the Eddic tales, where Thor himself, like he has to dress up as Freya in order to go and get his hammer back for the giants.
Oh,
so like I'm kind of waiting. This it's from the like Viking Society for Northern Research. It just kind of been published, so I'm like just waiting for the you know, sent from Europe to me. And I like, oh, that would be kind of like an interesting way of, you know, again, like another kind of tale, and seeing how like how it gets expressed there.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe you could add also the link to this book in the notes for our listeners.
Indeed, indeed. Hopefully, by the time this episode gets up, I should have the book, and I'm hoping to write a post about it. But like in the meantime, like we actually now have like a columnist dealing with Icelandic sagas.
Ooh.
Yes, Jóv Tarrasch. He's kind of done a couple of pieces, including like 10 tips on how to read an Icelandic saga.
Oh, that's great.
So it was again a really interesting, it was very good kind of first part, looking forward to hear the second part now.
Yeah, the second part is great too. It should be out in maybe 2 weeks after this episode. And I really enjoyed you know, talking with Matthew. As I keep saying that I don't know much about Icelandic and Norse history, but every time I'm interviewing people, you know, I'm learning about very, very interesting, very complex society. And these texts are so rich. The anecdotes are really full of life. But it's also about, you know, a society that is still slightly different from what I'm used to in continental Mediterranean Europe. It's very different. There are, of course, a lot of similarities. So I like this kind of otherness that I feel and that I hear in these interviews.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Like the medieval world has so many little spots. There's so much variety. So it makes it a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
You are listening to the Medieval Grad podcast, brought to you by medievalist.net. If you want to support us and this podcast, you can subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/medievalists. You can get a lot of great benefits on Patreon, including being able to hear the episodes early. We love doing this show and we really appreciate your help. I'm Lucie Lemonnier. You can find me on Instagram at The French Medievalist, and you can look me up on academia.edu. Thank you very much for tuning in. Au revoir.